Welcome to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham, in for Cynthia Canty. If you're still not sure what the Affordable Care Act means or what it does or doesn't do, you're not alone. Politics aside, today we'll take a closer look at Obamacare and what it means for you. And the unseasonably cool weather in Michigan, probably good for you, not so good for the crops. We'll find out what it all means. That story in 20 minutes. But first, by now you've heard a bit about Detroit's Chapter 9 bankruptcy filing. About half of Detroit's nearly $20 billion in debt is due to shortfalls in the funds for retiree benefits. According to emergency manager Kevin Orr's estimates, the pension funds are behind by about $3.5 billion and behind in retiree health care funds by about $5.7 billion. Detroit is not unique in its unfunded pension and retiree health care obligations. Other municipalities in the state are also behind. Anthony McGinney is the chief operating officer of Michigan Municipal League. He joins us now. So what is happening with the rest of these public employee pension and retiree health care funds, sometimes called other post-employment benefits or OPEB?
You know, for the most part, pension obligations are funded at a much higher level than your retiree health care type things, your OPEB benefits. Statewide, the OPEB liability is approaching $13 billion. There was a study done recently sort of quantifying that amount. When those benefits were promised, there was really no one thought about understanding the value of that future promise that they've made, and that was a problem.
Right, because no one understood that healthcare costs were going to go up as much as they did, and the practice of pay-as-you-go was pretty cheap at the time.
Exactly. As a matter of fact, I was at a presentation about a month ago, and someone cited the fact that in the 60s, when they first started to give health care, a family plan was $40 a month. There was also no accounting or actuarial guidance saying you should even quantify that. That's a relatively recent development. So any community of any significance in size or obligation would have an understanding of what that number is. But for an older community that's had unionized workforces for decades, that's a big number. And as you just cited, you know, Detroit's number alone is a staggering number. Statewide, it's an even bigger number.
So for the municipalities that have this problem, we've got a nearly $13 billion shortfall. That includes Detroit. And then for the state, even with some of the adjustments by the Snyder administration, which saved about $20 billion, the amount still underfunded is an estimated $49 billion, according to some documents I've seen. But everybody got a warning about this, right? I mean, the Government Accounting Standards Board about a decade ago told government entities they should start taking a hard look at these retiree health care costs, suggesting pay-as-you-go was unsustainable, that some other perhaps prepay system should be put in place, as the state has done for some of its retirees. So how well have municipalities looked at that?
Well, what it would require you to do actually was to understand the number initially. And there's really no requirement that you fund it. Local government has now understands this number. They understand that number during a time where they've seen dramatic declines in property values and state shared revenues, and they're struggling to provide basic core services. So you contrast that against, do we cut services even more to try to provide more advanced funding, understanding there's not a specific requirement to do so. And I think a lot of communities have elected to provide the services. I think they understand full well it is putting off the inevitable type
thing. They're kicking the can down the road.
Yeah. But I think what – you know, part of what's underlying this entire conversation is there really needs to be a new look at how we fund local government. I mean, the way that the municipal finance model works for everyone, that there's just not enough revenues to do some of that stuff. And another point that I think needs to be made, and it does come back to this whole idea of for decades not understanding. As you point out, for about the last decade or so, there's been a requirement to understand that number. But if you look from that date in reverse, take a community like Flint or Detroit, either one. They're actually very similar except the magnitude being different. When they incurred those costs, they were communities that were three times the size they are now. And essentially what they did is they undercharged for their full cost of services, because if they would have been advanced funding and things like that, they would have had theoretically collected more in taxes or diminished service or something. You wouldn't have this situation. So they now understand there's this bill due. They have one-third as many people to pay the bill that's now due. And the folks that enjoyed those services are essentially off the hook. They've stepped across an imaginary boundary that says I'm in, you know, a township on the other side or a different city, and avoiding the cost of doing that stuff. It's almost impossible, really, to try and deal with those costs that were built up over decades by a much bigger population and deal with those in that context. So that's another challenge I think that they're both really struggling with.
I want to discuss some of the political arguments. Some Republicans say look, Detroit was mismanaged by Democrats, and on top of that, the unions got whatever they wanted instead of addressing these shortfalls. That ignores falling property values, the huge drop in population in the city you alluded to. And at the same time, the private sector made adjustments, shifting from defined benefits, that is pensions, to defined contribution or a 401k type of system. The state went to defined contribution, I believe, back in 1997. So they're asking, why haven't these municipal governments taken a clue from them and faced the reality of the situation?
Well, I think there's a lot of people doing a lot of different things as it relates to the pension. But here's the part that's conveniently left out of that explanation of we need to be more like business. Number one, we didn't set the bar for what pension benefits should be. The auto industries and all of the support industries around autos are the ones that set the bar. Local government, in an attempt to compete for talent, had to match those types of benefits. Secondly, in local government, there's a lot of things that prevent or make it difficult to change the contracts unilaterally. For example, there was binding arbitration as it relates to police and fire, which are typically 50% or more of a local government's budget. Those unions had the opportunity to go to an arbitrator and argue, and that arbitrator would make that decision as to what those benefit levels would be or whatever. And what you saw as a result of that was a ratcheting over time. Many communities, I think, as a morale tool, would, if the police and fire had a certain level of benefits, say, well, I feel that the child of a DPW worker is just as entitled to health care as the child of a police officer or fireman. And so they tended to keep all ships rising in that regard. So there's also the prevailing guidance, I guess you would say, and it'll be interesting to see what the bankruptcy court finds as it relates to this, is once given those pensions and those things, you can't take that back from a public worker. Whereas in a private business, I know that many people, friends and family, who, open the mail one day and they have a letter that says, your retiree health care will be terminated on December 31st. Local government doesn't have the ability to do that. So even if that political will existed, and we could debate whether or not that exists or not, they don't have the ability to do that.
So what's the takeaway here? I mean, Detroit's filing for bankruptcy might be part of a wave of bankruptcy, maybe not right away, but in the next several years. So what can municipalities do?
I do think that people need to understand that. I mean, the problem is real, and the numbers are staggering. All of these are talked about in billions of dollars. And we don't really have a good model that over time is going to sustain that. And while, yes, a lot of communities are moving to different programs and we're seeing, reductions in retiree health or maybe not even having it at all, there's a lot of different things being put into place. The reality is that we talked about at the onset of this interview, there's almost $13 billion of liability out there. So we need a plan to address that. And we can't turn our back on the Detroits or the Flints or the places that, that were once the economic, drivers. And quite frankly, they still are. And that's, I think, the other part that people just sort of dismiss out of hand. If we truly turned our back and allowed them to just fail, I don't think that serves anyone's purposes. And so we need to come up, I think, with an approach that as a state and as a region allows us to be successful, provide those core services. If we can't provide and create places that matter, that people want to live in, then we're just going to continue this downward spiral.
All right. Things to keep in mind as we watch this bankruptcy. Thanks for the context. Anthony Maghini is with the Michigan Municipal League talking about how Detroit is not the only government entity with unmet obligations promised to its retirees. So now let's get an update about what's happening in this Detroit bankruptcy regarding pensions and health care for retirees, since it's such a big chunk of the city's debt. Joining us is Michigan Radio's Sarah Swick. Sarah, this week, Attorney General Bill Schuette stepped into the bankruptcy case. What's going on here?
Well, he stepped in on behalf of the city's pensioners who face possibly having their pensions cut in federal bankruptcy court. Schuette says that the Michigan Constitution protects vested public pensions, which in fact it does, and he has an obligation to go to bat for that to defend the state's constitution. However, the bankruptcy is in federal court, and it's widely believed that in this case, federal law is going to trump state law. So this decision rests largely in the hands of the bankruptcy judge.
For a guy who's pretty conservative, I mean, he staunchly defended the anti-union right to work law. This is kind of an interesting move. Any idea why he's doing this? I mean, you mentioned defending the constitution of the state, but any motive beyond that?
Well, I can't get into his head, obviously, but it does seem like that this is obviously something that's this idea that pensions could be cut in bankruptcy is something that's pretty disturbing to a lot of people, especially people with pensions, even if they're not directly affected by the Detroit bankruptcy. So I think he probably sees this as something that is going to be popular, a move that will be popular with older people who are perhaps dependent on pensions. And who knows where he's looking next in terms of electoral possibilities.
Right. He's up for re-election at least next year. Now, and the bankruptcy case, when will we next hear from the federal judge presiding over this bankruptcy?
Well, actually, some information just came out today about some suggestions that this judge, federal bankruptcy judge Stephen Rhodes, has made in terms of setting a timeline for how the bankruptcy will proceed. Now, remember that we don't actually know yet whether Detroit is eligible for Chapter 9 bankruptcy. They have to prove a whole slew of things, such as that they're insolvent, which basically everyone will acknowledge, but also a whole bunch of other things, including that they attempted to bargain in good faith with their many creditors. So it looks like Judge Stephen Rhodes wants to move that along pretty quickly and probably get that eligibility question decided by October. There is a conference hearing scheduled for Friday, so that will be the next time that we'll actually hear the judge speak and kind of get a sense of how fast this thing might move along.
Michigan Radio's Sarah Swick in Detroit, thank you.
Thank you, Lester.
Still to come, 40 Michigan authors are on the road for the 4th annual UP Book Tour. We'll talk with the headliner, author Bonnie Jo Campbell, about what you can expect. That story in 10 minutes. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham, sitting in for Cynthia Canty. An opinion piece caught our attention in the wake of the Detroit bankruptcy filing. The headline of the piece on the online magazine site Model D read, "Bankruptcy, the beginning of another opportunity." The author was Matthew Naimi. He's the founder of the nonprofit Recycle Here in Detroit. He described bankruptcy as the chance to finally address the city's dysfunction, and he joins us now. Let's start with that last point, Matthew. What do you mean by addressing the city's dysfunction?
Some of the things that attract people to Detroit in this latest wave of repopulation is the dysfunction in the city of Detroit. How things, you can buy a $500 house, you can live in a giant loft, and even some of the employer-led programs where they're incentivizing people to move into certain areas with cash or rent payments. I mean, that's not the sign of a functioning city. It attracts us, but ideally, you don't have $500 houses. So I think that kind of dysfunction is an attraction to the creative class, but it's not a sustainable way to operate a city.
Right. You use that term, creative class. That's a term that Richard Florida coined. What do you mean when you say people in the creative class?
Certain things get labeled like the creative class, and what it is, it seems that throughout the United States, there's a certain type of individual that sees, opportunity in what a lot of people would walk away from. Some type of a neighborhood that would seem seedy would attract somebody with a cheaper rent and allows an artist or a musician or somebody along those lines to utilize that type of environment to create art. That's my definition of the creative class. So people that see the opportunity in something that isn't developed.
Okay, so like you just said, you say in your piece that while the cheap real estate and the gritty aesthetic of the city meant opportunities for artists and young entrepreneurs, ultimately it's a sign of a broken system, and the creative class isn't going to fix that on its own. When I hear about these redevelopment and hip, trendy places, I always feel like that happens organically or not at all. I remember Governor Jennifer Granholm's Cool Cities program, which tried to put government incentives in place to foster such places. Do you think focusing on the resurgence of places like Midtown has been distracting people from the reality of life for most of Detroit's residents? I mean, are we developing, trying to attract the creative class at the expense of the rest of the neighborhoods?
The development that you see that has happened in the Midtown and downtown area There's great positive stories. Like I said in the piece, I lived downtown before I moved to Cass Corridor, which is now Midtown. And those are great stories, but it seems to be they're telling it's a tale of two Detroits. There's this part of Detroit that's coming back, and this part of Detroit that is not coming back. But we are one Detroit. The tax base needs to be spread out, and the investment needs to be spread out throughout the neighborhoods. Solid neighborhoods are what really bring the city back. And I do think that some of the attention paid to Midtown and downtown take away from what is really going on in the neighborhoods.
So what do guys like you in this creative class, I mean, are you straddling these two worlds?
When I moved to Detroit, I grew up in the suburbs. I went away to the University of Tennessee. And when I graduated, I came back. So by moving back to Michigan, I wanted to live in downtown Detroit, and I chose to move down here. I didn't move here to fix it. I moved here. The opportunity was there. And as I met my neighbors and introduced myself, I found myself seeing the opportunity to put things in place that I wouldn't have in other places. Recycle Here, the program that we started, was the first recycling program in the city of Detroit. We started that in 2006. That's about 40 years after the rest of the United States started thinking about recycling. So, I don't want to self-label myself being in the creative class, but I did create something.
So what about some of the other examples? I mean, how are we making this city work better? How are people who come in like you and said, it's a good place. I think we can build something here. How are other examples of that happening, and how is it making the whole city benefit?
Well, you've seen the success of Slo's in the Corktown corridor on Michigan Avenue. Just a simple restaurant that took a blighted corner and really changed the dynamic. A good friend of mine, Liz Blondie, started a dog daycare in the lower Cass corridor, which is it was a fairly rough area. And, by locating businesses there and bringing people there and showing them that, this is a nice neighborhood, we just have to continue to support it. I have a theory that the creative class kind of takes the edge off a neighborhood. A small business or entrepreneur actually, puts a business in for people to spend money. But we need jobs and investment in the neighborhoods so that money is there to be spent.
So let's look at bankruptcy then. You say it's a time for opportunity or a chance for opportunity. How might bankruptcy make things better beyond those trendy areas? Where are those opportunities?
I think that for so long, we've been trying to really fix Detroit, and everybody has been looking for the magic bullet. Like, what's the one thing that's going to fix Detroit? The magic bullet isn't bankruptcy, but it is going to address one of the things that we have to do to fix Detroit, and that is with our incredibly broken financial system. Spending that much money out of every tax dollar on debt service and whatnot, we need to fix that. We need to right-size that. Because with that change, some of the tax dollars can go towards services that we need to enhance the neighborhoods. So that's going to – I think bankruptcy with the plan in place will address that. And that allows people like myself to work on recycling and green issues, and we can start to address schools. But there's not a magic bullet. We need a machine gun full of magic bullets.
I get the feeling from the conclusion of your piece when you talk about Detroit being, quote, the people and relationships and connections and energy that happen when we learn to live together, end quote, that you're saying let the politicians and the bankruptcy court and the lawyers do whatever they need to do. We're going to keep going on. We're going to keep keeping it on. Is that what you're thinking of? And if so, what are you doing next?
Yeah, well, the way I look at it, bankruptcy at this point is out of our hands. We could feel sorry for ourselves. We could throw our hands up. We could leave. But I don't see that happening. I think that what a city is people working on projects, living together, creating each block, each street, each neighborhood, to making that better. This bankruptcy process is not going to stop that. And it just allows us to continue to focus on what we can control and make our world a better place, because the only way to make the world a better place is to make your own personal world a better place.
So what's next for you then? What do you think you might be able to contribute in the wake of this?
We're a city-funded program. We're the City of Detroit's recycling program. So obviously I have skin in the game. Bankruptcy could affect how our program operates. I'm not going to cry about that. I'm just going to continue to do what we do. We've grown every month since we started because we do something that brings people together. Recycle Here is far more than a recycling program. It allows people to actually interact, much as like I talk about in my piece, bringing people together, teaching people how to talk to neighbors, giving them the chances to encounter and talk about what's next. Those conversations and that energy is going to be what brings Detroit back. for what's next for me, continue to move forward. We do a lot of art pieces here, and I work in the Detroit Public Schools. If we really want to fix Detroit, it's generational. You know, so spend some time, let's fix the schools, talk to students, give them the opportunity to lead Detroit in the future.
Matthew Naimi is the founder of the nonprofit Recycle Here in Detroit, and he also authored an opinion piece in the online magazine Model D, Bankruptcy, the Beginning of Another Opportunity. Matthew, thanks very much.
Thank you very much, sir.
Let's turn now to what's going on up north. A group of Michigan writers is headed to the Upper Peninsula, where they are going to spend a couple of weeks making stops to talk about books, writing, and presumably talking a little bit about Michigan. Joining us to talk about the fourth annual Upper Peninsula Book Tour is Bonnie Jo Campbell. She's a Michigan author. Her works include the best-selling novel Once Upon a River and American Salvage, a collection of short stories. And we'll be talking with Ron Reike. He's also a Michigan author and the project director of the book tour. So, Bonnie, let's start with you. Why, I want to ask, are you drawn to write about Michigan? What attracts you?
Hey, Michigan is my place. It's my home. It's the place where all the most interesting people live. It's a place where the most resourceful people I can imagine are hanging out. And those are the kind of people I like to write about.
Now, we know that there are a lot of southern novels and authors. I want to know, when you describe a Michigan scene or you describe Michigan people, how do you let your readers know that these places and these characters belong to this place and nowhere else?
Well, you know, that's a kind of hard question to answer. It's like the person who says, "You have a Michigan accent." And I say, "What are you talking about? I talk normal. You know, you other people from the South have an accent." So to me, it just comes naturally that I'm writing about what I know, and I'm writing about the things I observe. And so Michigan just comes through as the center of the universe.
Ron, you've been gathering these writers for this UP book tour for a few years now. Why there, and who comes along on the tour?
The first year, Steve Wigg was the headliner. The second year, it was Steve Hamilton. Third year, Don Hall. And this year, it's Bonnie Jo Campbell. And the goal really is to get those names out there a lot more. It's like our greatest writers. You know, Bonnie Jo and Steve both have won the Michigan Author Award. So it's the Lifetime Achievement Award for the state of Michigan. And I just want to make sure that they're household names because they deserve it. Their writing is really, really important for us.
How many writers are going to be on the tour? How many stops? Give us a little description of what's happening.
It's more than 50 events all throughout the state of Michigan, a lot in the UP. There's, I believe, like 44 authors around there, maybe like 28 different cities. So definitely you have to check out Bonnie Jo Campbell on one of the stops. So she's really intriguing in person. She just has a lot to say, and she's wonderfully eloquent, much more so than I am. I'm very jealous of that. So she's someone that you want to see live. She has a definite energy to her that has that sort of like rock concert sort of appeal to it, where there's just so much that she gives to the audience. It's really wonderful.
Bonnie, when you're doing a reading and a book signing, what do you want your audience to know about you as an author, other than, you know, the book is for sale?
Well, I mean, I just want to bring literature to the audience, you know, and I'm just really grateful that they take an interest in what I'm writing. You know, I find that for bringing the writing to the public space, you know, bringing it to libraries and bookstores, you don't necessarily bring what are your, you know, most famous award-winning pieces. You want to bring pieces, poems, and stories that the listeners can connect to really easily. So I do try to carefully choose maybe some bits of writing that are funnier or more descriptive.
Do you talk about the writing process with your audience, or what goes through your head when you're, you know, first thinking about a concept, an idea?
Well, yeah, a lot of times at these events, there are a lot of writers, and they want, you know, they want to talk about the writing process. And, you know, my main goal when I talk to people is just to remove all the mystique of writing and just encourage them to write however they can best write. You know, I'm a writer who writes really bad stories, and then I work on them and make them better. There are some writers who, right out of the gate, can write, you know, wonderful, wonderful stories, but they tend to write, you know, a lot more slowly. So I like to just encourage people to find the way that they write best. And I do encourage people to write about the things that are very familiar to them. It's sort of a cliche, you know, to say write about what you know, but I think all of us do have to find ways to bring the material that we know best. We need to find ways to bring it to the attention and make it matter to our readers.
You mentioned you like to write what you know, and Michigan is what you know. Where'd you grow up?
Outside Kalamazoo, a little town called Comstock.
And how does that Michigan differ from, you know, where you're going to be touring for the next few weeks?
Yeah, well, where I grew up was pretty rural. It was kind of farmy, and I did grow up in the woods. And I think a lot of my characters could be very much at home in the Upper Peninsula. And I think of the Upper Peninsula as the most Michiganish of all of Michigan. It's the place that is the wildest, that has the most interesting landscape. And while people of Michigan are very capable and innovative everywhere, I think the UP may be the struggle of having a long, cold winter and of dealing with some tough economic times. I think it makes the people of the UP really tough and capable. And so those are the kind of people I like to write about in any case. So I'm really looking forward to connecting with some UP people and some UP writers.
Bonnie, when you're out on tour, I'm wondering if there's an author or a writer that you want to make sure you sit in and listen to their talk.
Oh, yeah. I'm looking forward to getting to hang out with Ellen Airgood, who wrote South of Superior. That's going to be really great. And I've always wanted to meet John Smolens, and I've never gotten to, so this is going to be really fun. And I love seeing Keith. I'll get to read with Keith Taylor a couple times. He's a poet from University of Michigan. And, I'm looking forward to meeting everybody.
That's the 4th Annual Upper Peninsula Book Tour. It takes place in August. We've been speaking to Bonnie Jo Campbell. She's a Michigan author, and she's headlining the tour. And Ron Reike, he's the tour project director. Thanks very much for joining us.
Oh, thank you. Good to talk to you both.
The weather's been really nice lately, at least I think so. Maybe a little cool at night. But this is July, people. What happened to the dog days of summer? I mean, we get 1 week of hot weather and now fall? I'd say it's time for an expert to weigh in, and that's why we called the MLive meteorologist Mark Torregrosso. We keep hearing the term unseasonably cool, Mark, from folks like you. What does that mean, and why is it happening?
Well, we should normally, on a day like today, have a high of about 80, low of about 60. In most spots of Michigan, maybe a little cooler in the north. On the weekend when we had highs of 65 and lows of 50, that is unseasonably cool, about 15 degrees cooler than normal. And the reason why, the biggest pocket of cool air is up in Canada, and it keeps rotating little spokes of cold air down into our areas. And it's really actually been a persistent pattern since about February. We did have a warmer than normal May, and we had a little stretch in July where it was just blazing hot. But in general, we've been below normal, and it's because that pocket of cold up in Canada has been very persistent since about February of this year.
So if it's this cool in the Lower Peninsula, what are the folks in the UP seeing? Did they get a summer this year?
They are a little bit cooler than what we've been, but not extremely cold. They're not wearing the snow coats just yet.
I'm not complaining. I kind of like this weather, but as you mentioned, the crops might be a problem. I've always been told the corn crop needs some hot weather. How is this affecting crops in Michigan?
It does. The corn crops all of them need some hot weather, and your garden, your tomatoes, your peppers, watermelons, melons especially, and cucumbers all need the hot weather. And so the way it's affecting it is it's getting the crop kind of behind in maturity. And like, say, for corn, you need to build up a certain amount of heat before the frost hits, or the corn kernel won't dry down properly, and then it costs a lot of extra money for the farmer to harvest it and dry it down using natural gas and using heaters.
So what's August look like for us?
August looks cooler than normal. I wrote a blog about that on MLive yesterday. August looks the next 14 days, which is how far out we can see with the computer models, look cooler than normal. And then if persistence is a good forecasting tool, the rest of August looks cool. And it looks fairly wet. I wouldn't say rainy and real soaker, but I would say we could see anywhere from an inch and a half to 3 inches of rain in the month of August here in Michigan, which is another good thing because this cooler weather is good for the lake levels because it brings the evaporation down. And then if we continue to get rains, we can go into fall with the lake levels actually going up some. And it's kind of the long-term process of if Mother Nature's changing her mind, then the lake levels may start to gradually go up over time.
Mark Torregrossa is MLive meteorologist, also the talent behind FarmerWeather.com. Thanks, Mark.
Thank you.
Coming up, what does Affordable Care Act mean for you? We'll get some answers. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham, in for Cynthia Canty. Few things are more politicized in the public arena than the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare. There's a lot of misinformation and disinformation about the insurance program. We're going to try to put politics aside for a bit and find out just what's happening now and what will happen as it continues to be phased in. Joining us are Helen Levy. She's a professor at the University of Michigan School of Public Health, the Institute for Social Research, and the Ford School of Public Policy. You must be very busy. And Thomas Buckmuller is a health economist and professor at University of Michigan's Ross School of Business. Let's start with the basics. In all the coffee shop conversations I've had, I hear people voice opposition to Obamacare because they're perfectly happy with the insurance they have right now through their employer. How will those folks be affected by the Affordable Care Act? Helen, let's start with you.
Those folks will mostly not be affected. So if you already have insurance from your employer, you're going to be able to keep it and not that much is going to change.
Are we likely to see any kind of price increases or price reductions if you already have insurance through your employer?
On the employer side, not that much. One change that does affect employers is preventive care is now going to be covered without a copayment. And so that's going to have a slight impact on premiums, but probably not noticeable compared to other changes.
So what is the overall goal of the Affordable Care Act? What are we trying to fix and how are we trying to fix it?
So the goal is to reach as many as we can of the approximately 50 million people who have no health insurance. And so the way we're trying to do that is by expanding access to individual health insurance coverage for people who could buy their own coverage but don't have an employer policy. And we are also trying to target the uninsured and give them coverage by expanding the Medicaid program in some states. And it remains unclear, as you know, whether Michigan will be one of those states.
Right. We're going to talk about that a little later. We're hearing some dire predictions that the cost of health care is going to skyrocket for some people, particularly for the small business employers and so forth. We see others where states are coming out and finding out that insurance premiums are going to be a lot lower. We're getting a lot of mixed messages here. What's likely to happen?
Well, I think that the question of what happens to premiums is a little more complicated. It depends on who you are. If you're somebody right now who has a chronic health condition, who's older, you may not be able to get insurance in the individual market. And so the Affordable Care Act is going to bring down premiums for you and make insurance more affordable. On the other hand, if you're somebody who's very young and healthy, the premiums that you face are likely to go up. At the same time, if you're buying insurance in the individual market, you may be eligible for new premium tax credits, which are going to lower the net cost to the consumer.
There's a lot of concern that this is a mandate, and I'm wondering who's going to be having to pay this? What kind of penalties are we talking about if they don't buy this insurance? Helen?
So the penalty is not huge necessarily compared to the cost of insurance. It's about $800 in 2014. And there are exemptions from the penalty for people that would face economic hardship if they had to buy coverage.
So we're going to see some subsidies, but somebody's got to pay for subsidies for this.
Oh, that's right. So there are subsidies for people who don't have access to employer-sponsored coverage. There are subsidies for those people to buy coverage through these health insurance exchanges that are being set up. And there's a tax credit that limits what you have to pay as a fraction of your household income.
Actually, healthcare exchanges is something we're going to have to define before we get finished too, because that's a confusing part of it. You're listening to Stateside, and today we're talking about the Affordable Care Act. Our guests are Thomas Buckmuller with the University of Michigan's Ross School of Business and Helen Levy. She's a professor with the Ford School of Public Policy. Now, I said we try to keep politics out of this, but right now in Lansing, the legislature is getting close to an agreement with some limitations on expanding Medicaid. Medicaid expansion was at first mandated by the Obamacare plan, but the Supreme Court ruled, hey, you can't do that. You don't have the power to do that. So according to a Bloomberg Businessweek article I read, quote, that's left low-wage workers in a bind. They make too much to qualify for Medicaid in its present form, but too little to afford a plan their employer might offer, and they don't earn enough to qualify for the subsidies available to the uninsured who buy plans on the state-run Obamacare marketplaces. What exactly does Medicaid expansion have to do with this Affordable Care Act? How does it fit into the puzzle?
So the Medicaid expansion nationally would account for about half of the gains in coverage. And this is for people with family incomes up to 138% of the poverty level, which is about $30,000 for a family of four. So these are people who, for whom insurance is very expensive, and this provides them a chance to get coverage at zero cost.
If we don't approve a Medicaid expansion, will there be a hole in the Obamacare coverage?
There's going to be a big hole. People who can least afford coverage are going to remain uninsured. There's also going to be a hole in the state budget. The estimates are that over 10 years, taking the Medicaid expansion will actually lower state costs rather than increase them.
And there's concern that we might not see that money, that the federal government might renege on the deal. Is that a reality or a likelihood?
Well, no one could predict that. But I guess the thing to keep in mind is that if the federal government changed the terms of the deal they're offering, then Michigan can always decide to drop the expansion.
What's already in place with the Affordable Care Act? How am I benefiting from it now if I am?
Well, if you have a young adult child, you may have been able to keep him or her on your insurance up to the age of 26, which you couldn't necessarily have done before. You may now have, as Tom mentioned, access to preventive care without a copayment that you didn't have before. And then for the Medicare program, there have been a number of changes that have gone into effect already. And I think these mostly people don't associate with the Affordable Care Act, but increased quality reporting, for example, for hospitals.
And delivery system reforms. There's new accountable care organizations, which are coordinated care efforts designed to improve quality and lower the cost of care.
And better coverage already of medication for some seniors, as I understand.
That's right. There was an increase in Medicare drug benefits.
So that's what we have to date. What's next? What are we going to see change that people need to be aware of?
So I think the big new thing people should know about is these health insurance exchanges, and that's going to be a place where you can go buy health insurance coverage if you don't get it from your job. And if you're lower income, you can get a subsidy from the federal government to get that coverage.
So these are going to be private insurers. There's going to be a menu of them, and I can pick the plan that best fits my circumstance. Is that correct?
That's right. You can pick between different carriers, and you can pick between different coverage levels, depending how much out-of-pocket cost you'd like to bear.
Now, there was recently a decision to delay enforcing the Affordable Care Act's requirements for employer health insurance until 2015. What are the pros and cons of that, and what will it mean for people who are employed but their employer doesn't provide health insurance now?
Well, eventually, to get access to the exchanges, you need to be able to show that you're not eligible for affordable employer insurance. So in the first year, I'm not sure what exactly is going to happen. By 2015, though, the mandate will be in place, and if your employer doesn't offer it, then you can go to the exchange and qualify for a tax credit.
There's a lot of concern by the employers that they're going to get stuck with a huge bill that they've never had to pay before because they haven't offered benefits like that.
That's right. There is that concern on the part of some employers, but one thing to keep in mind is that the overwhelming majority of employers who potentially face this penalty, because they're large employers, the overwhelming majority of them already offer health insurance to their employees, so 95%. Of employers with more than 50 employees.
It's more than 50 is the
cutoff. Yes, that's the cutoff.
So what about these restaurants that have, you know, a thin margin of profit and they might just have 55 employees? I mean, that's going to be a tough place for them to go.
That's the type of employer that's really on the margin where they're going to be affected. Large enough to be considered large, but low wage enough where they don't really have, a lot of ability to increase compensation.
One of the things I've been confused by is this pre-existing condition insurance plan. Different states are doing different things. What is this plan, and can you or will you soon be able to get health insurance in Michigan if you have a pre-existing condition?
Well, through the exchanges, you will be able to get insurance regardless of whether you have a pre-existing condition, regardless of your health status, your age. It will be no longer possible for an insurance company to deny you coverage or to limit that coverage. The pre-existing condition pool was sort of a bridge program to get us from 2010 to 2014 when the exchanges come online.
But now it's delayed till 2015 or not? Or is that
no, the exchanges will come online in January.
Okay.
So you'll be able to go there. Again, choose from menu of plans. Your price, the price that you're quoted will be based on your age within limits, but not on your health status.
In January, what are we going to be required to do? And if we do nothing, what happens?
I want to point out first, Lester, that an important date isn't so much January as October, which is when open enrollment starts for the exchange plans. So mm-hmm. if you currently don't have coverage through your employer, you should be thinking about signing up starting in October for health insurance coverage through the exchange. And one reason to do that is when you file your taxes 17 months later, 18 months later, you're going to need to show that you had health insurance. Otherwise, you're going to face a penalty for not having it.
But in Michigan right now, we don't know whether we're going to try to do some partnership or default to federal. Is there going to be an exchange in October in the state?
There will be an exchange. The federal government's going to be taking the lead on that. But I think eventually we might see Michigan take on more and more responsibility. I mean, it'd be nice to have an exchange that was run by the state and where they have more expertise in the local market, better understanding of local providers.
This is Stateside, and we're talking about the Affordable Care Act with Helen Levy with the Ford School of Public Policy and Thomas Buckmuller with University of Michigan's Ross School of Business. We've been talking about patients so far. I want to go to the other side of it. How are doctors reacting to the implementation of Obamacare? Let's start with you, Helen.
Well, I've heard mixed reactions from my friends and coworkers who are physicians. Some people welcome the types of changes that it's bringing for people who desperately need access to care and have limited access because they're currently uninsured. Others are unhappy with it because of the changes that it's bringing to the way Medicare pays doctors and hospitals. So I think it sort of depends on your perspective, what reaction physicians are having to it.
Increasingly, I've heard about especially primary care doctors who are saying, I'm tired of all the paperwork from the insurance companies. I'm tired of all the Medicaid and Medicare paperwork. I'm going on a cash-only basis, and there are more of them who seem to be threatening to do this as Affordable Care Act is implemented. Are we going to see a shortage of doctors before this is all over with? Who will accept the plan or a plan?
I think the best evidence is no. I mean, I think that's going to vary a lot by market. There's going to be some areas where capacity is already tight and you're bringing new people into the system. One thing we might see further down the line is sort of a push to change practice models. So make greater use of nurse practitioners, make greater use of non-physician providers. And that could be a nice benefit of the reforms.
What are the hospitals coming down on Affordable Care Act? What will change for them and their patients?
Well, the hospitals really, for them, the important issue is the Medicaid expansion. Because if Medicaid doesn't expand, then they're going to continue to see large amounts of uncompensated care. At the same time, there's going to be reductions in federal funding because when the law was passed, it was assumed that we wouldn't need to fund uncompensated care. So Michigan hospitals in particular are really devoted to getting the expansion passed.
One of the things that this was supposed to do is address higher and higher health care costs. And I keep thinking we're trying to fix the symptoms rather than deal with the real issue here. Does anybody know why in the last 30 years we've seen this astronomical increase in health care costs?
Well, we do think that a lot of it is technological innovations, many of which have been very beneficial for health. So we don't want to lump all spending together. Some spending is better than others. So I would say that the focus of the Affordable Care Act and other current discussions around reform isn't so much about lowering costs as it is about finding value. So you want to incentivize providers and patients to do the kinds of things that are very high value in terms of improving health and not do the things that are lower value. So that's That's the current focus.
Part of that preventative care effort to make sure that people stop smoking and start eating right and exercising, it ends up saving everybody a lot more money a lot faster, I guess.
There's also, I think, a lot of emphasis on changing the way we pay providers, moving away from a system that rewards them for quantity and reward them more for quality and for efficiency. So moving away from fee-for-service to models where they're being held responsible for population health.
So instead of concentrating on volume, we're concentrating on value of care.
Exactly.
So when this all rolls out, when the Affordable Care Act is completely implemented, what will the health care and insurance landscape look like for the average consumer?
Well, for the average consumer who currently has employer-sponsored health insurance, it's going to look about like it does now, except with the added security of knowing that if you lose your job or you decide you want to start your own business, there's going to be another place for you to get health insurance when you need it, even if you're not part of an employer group anymore.
And that market is going to be more competitive and have more choices than the current individual market does today.
Thomas Buckmueller is a health economist and professor at the University of Michigan's Ross School of Business. And Helen Levy is a professor at the University of Michigan School of Public Health, the Institute for Social Research, and the Ford School of Public Policy. Thanks very much for coming in.
Thank you.
Thank you, Lester.
Really strong demand for licenses to hunt wolves in the Upper Peninsula is prompting the state to delay the sale of those licenses until September. Michigan Radio's Lindsay Smith has a report saying wolf hunting licenses were supposed to go on sale Saturday.
The Department of Natural Resources still plans to sell up to 1,200 licenses. They'll cost Michigan residents $100. Non-residents will pay $500. DNR spokesman Ed Golder says only 43 wolves can be killed, though, and only in three specific areas in the Upper Peninsula.
They set those targets in those areas specifically because those have been areas of chronic conflict with wolves. That includes killing of livestock and pets and even human safety concerns in some areas.
However, no attacks on humans have been reported in Michigan. The wolf hunting season opens November 15th. I'm Lindsay Smith, Michigan Radio News.
Here's a case of marketing versus reality. If you graduate from a Michigan law school, should you be entitled to a refund if you don't find a satisfactory job? A federal appeals court today said no. The case involved some ticked-off graduates from the Thomas M. Cooley Law School. 12 Cooley graduates said they were misled by rosy employment statistics published by the school. But the appeals court says Michigan's consumer law doesn't apply and the graduates put too much emphasis on Cooley's job survey of other graduates. Sounds a bit like past performance does not guarantee future results. The appeals court affirmed a similar decision by a federal judge in Grand Rapids. Seems if these law students would have done just a little homework, they would have found the legal profession is more than saturated in most areas, especially here in Michigan. There are more lawyers than the other profession people love to hate, reporters. By the way, in the interest of full disclosure, I should note that Cooley Law School financially supports Michigan Radio. Okay, here on Stateside, we always want to hear from you. What are your thoughts about what's going on in the news? Let us know. You can find us on Facebook. Search for Stateside with Cynthia Canty. On Twitter at Stateside Radio. And on our website, michiganradio.org. Today's Stateside was produced and directed by Mercedes Mejia. Our executive producer is Zoe Clark. Our engineer today is Tony Brown. Contributors are Allie Billings, Austin Davis, Erica Decker, Emily Fox, Katie Theory, and April Van Buren. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Lester Graham. Thanks for listening.